Call the next, the last case for the day, United States versus Gerard and Langley.
And Brown.
Mr. Eberle?
Yes, Mr. Eberle, a court appointed for Ms. Brown on appeal. Ms. Brown defended herself at trial, arguing that she worked every one of those hours that she claimed during the 3 or 4 years that earned her about $19,000 working for Ms. Lee, that she didn't conspire with Ms. Lee, who didn't even like her, that she didn't lie to the agents, and that she truly believed that the services for which she claimed compensation were compensable under Medicaid. She believed this because that's what she was trained to believe. Any paper shuffling she did on behalf of Ms. Lee was done at Ms. Lee's insistence and not with any intent to defraud the government. Now, to help her prove this, Your Honor, she intended to call two witnesses, also former employees of A New Beginning. Those witnesses would have testified, among other things, that this is the way things ran there. They were told that this was okay, that these services were covered, that they would testify as to how she was trained or mistrained. The problem was that as soon as these witnesses were placed on the defense witness list, they were visited by two government agents who came in and presented them with a case full of documents and interviews that said, look, this is what you've done at A New Beginning. It is our opinion that what you did was a crime. And no problem, we're not prosecuting you, but if you get up there and deny any of this or tell us any lies, you're going to be prosecuted yourselves. And these witnesses instantly decided that they were not going to testify. Miss Allen was one of them. She immediately called Miss Brown and said, I don't want to get in trouble, I don't want to testify. Miss Randall, the other witness, basically went into hiding. At the hearing on the motion to quash the indictment, Miss Allen pleaded the Fifth Amendment. Miss Randall was hauled in there only after hiring an investigator to find her because she avoided service of process. So it is clear that there's certainly a cause in fact that the witnesses decided not to testify after being visited by these government agents. Now, we can see that these agents were not impolite. This has been argued a lot, but that's not the point. They were polite. We accept that. We also accept that the government is free to interview defense witnesses, free to investigate crimes, free to warn about perjury.
What were the statements that the agents made to these witnesses false?
I'm sorry?
What were the statements that the agents made to these witnesses false?
There were no false statements made to these witnesses.
Did they give them accurate information?
Well, what was the base?
What I'm saying to you is that if it is the case that the agents, I understand your argument about intimidation, and that certainly can be intimidating to be told that. But
yeah.
But on the other hand, if the agent knows that this person has got the problems, and for various reasons they're not going to indict them because they're small fish and that kind of thing. But yet, if they get up and perjure themselves, they'll go after them. And is it intimidation or is it just fairness to the witness?
Well, here's the problem, we think. First of all, they were not going to prosecute these witnesses, and they knew that.
Yeah.
And in a sense, that was in a way dishonest.
Unless they got on the stand and perjured themselves.
Right, and the other problem is, these witnesses weren't like, oh, the gig is up. We were going to lie, and now we're not going to. These witnesses, just like Mrs. Brown, thought what they were doing was perfectly okay. And what happened was these agents said, hey, you committed a crime. Now you know it. Now keep quiet. And because there was no chance they were going to prosecute these witnesses anyway, and because they spent most of the time during these interviews telling them what they did was wrong, rather than inquiring about Ms. Brown, we believe that that constitutes a substantial interference with their free and unhampered choice to testify.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sloan?
Good morning. I represent Melinda Langley. The issue I presented relates to or begins with a motion in limine that's filed by the government. They want to introduce evidence that my client allegedly had given marijuana and alcoholic beverages to twins who were, I think, 13 years old when this began. I opposed the motion and correctly predicted in my opposition memorandum that because the male twin had a prior conviction, which was for marijuana, wasn't sure at the time it was marijuana or something else, that it was going to make the prejudice even worse. Because I said, will this witness claim that Ms. Langley started him a path to jail? Would the government argue this to the jury, or will the jury be left to speculate about it? The government chose option three. The unfair prejudice of the testimony of these other crimes wasn't something that was going to be wiped away by a jury instruction. And that's because of the emotional nature of it. The prejudice involved would be the notion that a woman was supposed to be caring for these children had turned one of them into, you know, to a life of crime. All right? And if the jury felt that, then there was no way an instruction to disregard it was going to do anything more than, you know, remind them of that fact. Now, and what really happened, which I'm sure you read, is just brief questioning. It's asked, how old were you? About 13. Was this the first time you ever smoked marijuana? Yes, sir. I noticed you're in an orange jumpsuit. Why are you wearing an orange jumpsuit? I'm in jail for weed. Okay? Now, they didn't argue that in the argument of the jury. The jury was left to consider that, and it was pretty clear what they were driving at. Now, the trial court granted the government's motion in limine, and in doing so, gave no reasons for it. Now, the first argument I have is that the balancing test of Federal Rules of Evidence 403 should apply, although in cases where the evidence has been held to be intrinsic, they tend not to apply 403, but they don't specifically say that it's inapplicable. But the judge never made that determination. We don't know. And it's a peculiar case for intrinsic evidence because you have what is essentially a paper crime. The crime is signing false documents, signing false documents. I haven't seen any cases where they're dealing with, you know, a white-collar crime and they bring in something like a drug offense or something like that as if it's evidence. We've seen drug offenses where they bring in guns and things like that. So
was this evidence brought in to impeach her once she took the stand?
They claimed that what they were bringing the evidence in, well, it effectively impeached her beyond, you know, regular impeachment. They claimed that this was necessary to show that she wasn't doing the things that were on her timesheet. But that really wasn't an issue because her testimony and when she met with the FBI agent, she, by the way, was not charged with false statements. She freely admitted what she was doing and why she was doing it. So she didn't get on the stand and she didn't tell the FBI agent, oh, yes, everything on the timesheet I did. What she said was that she had been told to go ahead and do it. Okay? And she had been told to go ahead and do it by Acacia Lee. And Acacia Lee was, yeah, they had classes where they were told this is where you're supposed to do it, but she would pull them aside and say, look, you can't put this down in your timesheet. We can't pay. You have to put it down this way. You have to do this. She didn't know that that was fraud, and so she was doing it. So they came in and said, well, look, we need to show that she wasn't providing the services. But it was never really an issue, and I argued that to the trial judge. This wasn't the defense that was going to be put on. And if we had done that, then maybe they could have come in on rebuttal. But instead, what happens is the jury's led to believe that she had committed these crimes and turned a 13-year-old boy into a life of crime. That doesn't get washed away very easily. Now, whether you want to do intrinsic evidence, or 404B really doesn't seem to apply here, okay? But it wasn't harmless error There were 13 counts against her, excluding the conspiracy count. She was convicted on 10 and acquitted in the other three. The 10 she was convicted on all related to the twins. There were five for each of the twins. So was the jury punishing her for what she had done? I don't know. Not only that, the government had represented originally in its memorandum that they corroborated one another. And as I show in my brief, they didn't. She never testified that she did any marijuana or anything. And he claimed that she had. And the stories were just not consistent. But the problem is once the jury starts looking at somebody out the corner of their eye, you've got a problem that you can't get around very easily. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. You've saved your time on rebuttal. Ms. Bartholomew.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Kate Bartholomew, and I represent the appellant, Ms. Ernestine Girard. May it please the Court, Ms. Girard has provided multiple issues in her brief. I'm going to begin with the issue of the dates that was brought up in the trial court. In the indictment, Ms. Girard is charged with having made false statements to agents on August 26th, but at trial, the agent testified that, in fact, those statements occurred on April 26th. That's a five-month difference. And although the language in the indictment says on or about April 26th, I think the five-month difference is not reasonable and is significant when you're dealing with a one-time occurrence crime, not an ongoing crime. The government, in their brief, cites a number of cases where 5 months or longer has been acceptable for variations in dates. But those cases involve mail fraud and various other ongoing crimes. They do cite one case that is a drug case, that's a one-time issuance case, where the difference in date was 1 day. 1 day, I think, fits in on or about. 5 months does not. In her sufficiency argument, Ms. Girard also raises two other issues. One is her mental capacity, which was a big issue in the course of the trial, and her ability, not incompetency, but her ability to form the mens rea to commit this crime, to have the intent to commit a fraud and a conspiracy. And the testimony in that case, although it indicates that she does have daily living skills ability, she can sign her name, she can cash a check and do some basic skills, it also indicated that she has the verbal communication capacity to understand and to read at the level of a first grader. Her actions in this case involve signing her name to documents. That's the government's allegation. There's actually no proof in the entire record that any signature that says Ernestine Girard was signed by Ernestine Girard. There are a number of statements in the case that indicate that the government's key witness, Ms. Lee, fraudulently signed and forged many of the documents in question. No one identified Ernestine Girard's signature as actually belonging to Ernestine Girard. But even if we assume that the jury was correct in their assumption that it was her signature, she signed blank forms. That's the evidence in the case. She signed blank forms because that was the only way that she could obtain her paycheck. There's no understanding or comprehension on her part with her limited verbal communication abilities and understanding to commit the mental requisite that it would take for this level of a conspiracy. I think that's very significant in her case. We've also argued sentencing enhancement issues. One is the obstruction of justice sentencing enhancement, for which she received two additional points. The evidence in this case indicates that she was at the end of the chain of the investigation. And although she was convicted of 3 counts of making false statements to FBI agents, the agents went in with all of the evidence against her before they ever spoke to her. She in no way hampered their investigation at that point in time because their investigation was substantially complete. And so I do not believe that the sentencing enhancement for obstruction of justice was validly applied in her case.
Does it matter? I think the guidelines say attempted obstruction of justice. Does that make a difference whether it's an attempt or actual obstruction?
I don't think it makes a difference in this case because there's no hampering of the investigation because the investigation was substantially complete. If she's the person on the front end, perhaps it does make a difference. But she's the person all the way down at the bottom end. So I don't think in that case the enhancement is appropriate. There's also an enhancement for using her children in the fraud. And there was testimony that a witness observed her children copying forms that may have ultimately been submitted to Medicaid. But there is no testimony that indicates that the children knew what the forms were for, that they were doing it for the purpose of the Medicaid, or that she was trying to incorporate them into the fraud. They may have simply been copying them for educational purposes, skills purposes. Understand there's some skills issues with some of her children. We don't know what they're copying them for. And so I don't think there is an intent that comes across in the course of the case for her to incorporate her children into the fraud in that manner directly. There certainly is no testimony that indicates that. I see that my time has expired.
Thank you. Mr. Ginsburg.
May it please the court, my name is Jordan Ginsburg, and with me is Patrice Sullivan. We were trial counsel on this matter before the district court. The appellants collectively assert 8 distinct grounds of reversible error they argue the district court committed before, during, and after their trial and convictions. I'll address each in turn, beginning with Brown's pretrial allegations of error. In particular, Uta Brown asserts that the court erred in denying her motion to dismiss the charges against her based on prosecutorial misconduct because the government allegedly first intimidated her witnesses into declining to testify and secondly restricted her access to a government witness. I'd note that the court ruled on the defendant's motion only after devoting immense attention to the matter, conducting what amounted to in total 3 days of hearing, and then directly applying controlling law, holding that Brown had not presented direct evidence of intimidation or stating that nothing in the record indicated that the government's conduct had interfered substantially with the witness's free right to testify. Now, with respect to the witness intimidation assertion concerning Lakeeta Randall and Samaj Allen, the evidence and the testimony adduced at those hearings indicated that the government acted properly. Under controlling Fifth Circuit precedent, there's nothing inherently wrong with interviewing either Lakeeta Randall or Samaj Allen, even if Brown had intended to call them as a witness, since the parties enjoy an equal right to contact the witnesses and seek an interview. Furthermore, it's okay to investigate or research the witnesses before doing so. What the case law has consistently focused on is the motive and behavior of the government in engaging in contact with the witnesses, and in this case, there was distinct proof that there was no ulterior motive. So the Fifth Circuit has repeatedly looked at the government's intent and noted that, as the Fifth Circuit noted in the Whittington case, it's okay to interview a witness as long as the conduct is not designed to intimidate that witness. With respect to that issue and the way the government conducted itself, the agents conducted themselves during the interview, there was no indication that there was any harassment or threatening behavior. In fact, Samaj Allen testified that she found the interview that lasted approximately 2 hours to be friendly, joking, and non-threatening. In fact, she went so far as to say that she found her interactions with the agents to be less divisive, less upsetting to her, less intimidating than her discussions with Defendant Brown's own trial counsel at the time, Avery Pardee. At this point, I want to correct what Mr. Aberle said during his statements, that the government spent most of their time during the interview telling the agents or telling the witnesses what they did wrong. There's no indication in the record that that's what took place. The agents began their interviews, their interactions with both witnesses by making their standard warnings that the interview, if they chose, would be voluntary, that they were free to terminate the interview at any time. In fact, Lakeeta Randall chose to do that. I think she indicated she had to go to church. She stated, the agents indicated that they could refuse to answer any questions that they wished. And at that point, once they confirmed that both witnesses wished to go forward, they reminded the witnesses of the importance of saying anything at that time to make sure that, what they say is done truthfully, is said truthfully. The record further indicated that there was no accusatory statements made by the witness, made by the agents to the witnesses. Both interviews took place in places of comfort. In the case of Samaje Allen, in her office; in the case of Lakeeta Randall, in her own home with her husband was present. Furthermore, with respect to Lakeeta Randall, when the agents believed that she made false statements to them because of her possible status as a defense witness, they chose not to confront her about those, let them go, and move on through the interview. In fact, again, Avery Pardee, who testified during these hearings, stated that she had no idea why Randall didn't want to testify. And in fact, if you look at the timeline, there's really no proof that, the interaction with the government, irrespective of, how the interview took place, had anything to do with the decision not to testify. Immediately after the government's interview with the witnesses, Lakeeta Randall told a representative for Brown's counsel that she still wished to go forward, and it wasn't until many weeks later that she changed her mind and told defense counsel's representative that she, at that point, wished not to testify. In short, the evidence showed, as in the Dupree case, that there's no evidence the government sought to threaten or harass any of the witnesses. And with respect to the perjury admonitions, both prior to the interviews, any false statement admonition, and then at trial, there's nothing wrong with telling a witness of the importance of testifying truthfully. And there's no evidence that in this case the agents did it with the purpose of trying to coerce silence. There was no mention during the interviews, the record reflects, of testifying or whether the witnesses would testify or what they might say if they chose to testify. The only indication is in response to a question that Samaje Allen asked the agents, which is whether she was going to have to testify and what happened, and the agents instructed that if she received a trial subpoena from the defendants, that she had to get those answers about when and where, the logistics, from the defendants. And at that point, they reminded her that if she did testify, she would have to do so truthfully.
Were they told that they were not the subject of a, they weren't the target of prosecution, and that they had no plans to prosecute them?
They were told that they were not subjects, they were not targets of the investigation. That they were instructed that the information they were trying to receive had to do with the existing case against Unibrown. And with respect to the issue that Mr. Aberle didn't speak to, I want to touch on briefly, and that has to do with the access to the government's witness, Acacia Lee. There is no fundamental right to interview a witness, only to seek access, and that's an opportunity that Brown's trial counsel had. The government, and to be quite candid, I haven't been doing this for very long, but it was a strange series of events. But nevertheless, the meeting on March 25th was scheduled with the government through Acacia Lee's trial counsel on March 19th. The record reflects that
It is a delicate enterprise, and lay witnesses, FBI agents, what they must disclose, that they identify themselves and so forth, that in of itself is a frightening proposition. And so it's a delicate thing that the agents, and they just know that. They're well-trained and experienced. All I'm saying is that it's one that has to be handled with a great deal of sensitivity and care, because how many witnesses chose not to testify after they were interviewed?
Judge Higginbotham, I would agree with you. It is a delicate situation. It's one that the agents approached very delicately. With respect to my knowledge, there were two witnesses that chose not to testify. There's nothing in the record to suggest that there were any others.
Two witnesses were lost or that did not testify?
That's been the allegation set forth by Ms. Brown's counsel. I have no indication of any others that they...
Were both of them represented? One of them had a lawyer, the other one did not, or what was the situation there?
No, Judge,
neither had a lawyer.
Neither Lakeeta Randall nor Samaje Allen had an attorney. Now, with respect to their second allegation concerning limiting the government's access to Acacia Lee, which was a witness for the government, Acacia Lee had an attorney.
Didn't have a lawyer.
Because she was in the process of going through the legal process herself. And the interview that was created, that was set up between the government and Ms. Lee, was created through her attorney and went through all the appropriate channels. The government had no idea where Ms. Lee was when she didn't show up at 10 a.m. on March 25th. Agents had come in from out of town. Individuals were at the offices waiting for her. She didn't show up. The agent called to figure out where she was, and only at that time learned that, first and most importantly, that she wasn't where she was expected to be, which is in the office at the previously prior scheduled meeting, but that she happened to be in the offices of one of the trial attorneys, but that the meeting had not yet started because one of the another one of the defendant's attorneys hadn't even shown up yet. At that point, it's our understanding that the record reflects that Mr. Belfield, Casualty's attorney, advised her to meet with the government and keep that previously scheduled meeting. And during that meeting, the government told Ms. Lee very clearly that she was more than welcome to meet with defense counsel.
So I'm not clear in my mind, but where the witnesses were interviewed, where were they? Did they go to their homes, or how did they do that?
So, Judge, there were three witnesses. Lakita Randall was interviewed in her home with her husband present. Samaj Allen was interviewed approximately for 2 hours in her place of employment, in her work. She has an office. I believe she's some sort of school administrator, and that's where they met her. And Akasia Lee, which is a third and separate issue, met in the office of the United States Attorney. And I would also note that Samaj Allen made clear that during those 2 hours, not only was it not accusatory, she went so far as to say that she joked back and forth with the agents and had, I don't know, could probably be called lighthearted banter. But I agree with your earlier statement that it is a sensitive topic when agents come to anybody's home. I'd be concerned if they came to mine. But the fact that they conducted themselves properly such that Ms. Allen felt comfortable joking with them and interacting in a lighthearted manner demonstrates the way in which they interacted with them and the seriousness with which they took their job. I'm beginning to run short on time and still have several more areas to cover, so I just want to briefly touch on the issue that in the event that you should conclude that there was any error in the court's ruling with respect to Akasia Lee or Samaj Allen and Lakita Randall, I would argue that that error was harmless. The error that Ms. Brown attempted to obtain from Samaj Allen and Lakita Randall, she was able to get through numerous other witnesses that testified, and in any event, the government's evidence was overwhelming. With respect to Melinda Langley, the defendant, Ms. Langley, is claiming that the trial court erred in admitting evidence that she gave drugs and alcohol to two of her patients, Joe P. Boy and Joe P. Girl. As an initial matter, this information became relevant because Melinda Langley put her the issue of intent on the forefront when she pleaded not guilty. And furthermore, during the opening statement,
I didn't follow that. What drug and alcohol became relevant on the issue of intent?
That's correct, Judge.
Intent to file fraudulent document? I'm not following you.
Sure. The information, it wasn't just a matter of filing fraudulent documents. The documents represented what she was doing and what she said she was doing and the times in which she said she was doing it with respect to particular children. Now, these particular documents, what she represented during her opening statement was that these documents, that it was a mistake. She didn't know what she was doing was wrong. And one very fundamental and important way to demonstrate that what she knew, she can't possibly have reasonably thought that giving drugs and alcohol to minor children was an acceptable PCS service. We presented quite a wide variety of evidence, including that she'd attended trainings learning what PCS services was. But in addition, one of the only ways to prove the negative, which is to show what she wasn't doing with the children.
I didn't hear you.
One of the only ways to prove, try to prove a negative, which is to show that she wasn't providing PCS or personal care services to these children, is to show that what she was doing with them. And while we didn't have the opportunity of knowing what her defense was going to be when we were putting on our case in chief. It was foreseeable to think that she may have said, you know, I didn't know the services had to be in their home or something.
So was this brought in as cross-examination through her or cross-examining her, or was this brought in your case in chief, or how did this come out?
Judge, it was brought in initially in the case in chief when we questioned the our witnesses, who were the children who supposedly she represented as having provided these services to.
Well, I can understand why she her relationship with the students in general, but the drugs and alcohol to minors, that's a pretty heavy load to put on I still don't quite get the connection of intent to defraud the government, which is what I assume you're talking about in this scheme. The relevance seems to me to be pretty weak, and the prejudice substantial. So that's troubling.
Well, the purpose was twofold, Judge. It was first. The intent, she made clear in her opening statement that she didn't think that what she was doing was wrong, and that she was just following some orders, and that she didn't know that filling out documents was inappropriate. But it can't possibly have been the case that representing that you are washing children and doing some of the providing PCS services, it's not an honest mistake to say, I was just filling out documents that I didn't know was wrong, when in fact that you're providing drugs and alcohol to children, because that can't possibly be a PCS service. And I would also note that it shows...
Is it possible that she was providing the service and giving out drugs and alcohol? I mean, it would not be inconsistent with her not doing her job that she was giving out alcohol and drugs. I mean, she could still be providing the services required and in addition doing these other improper things. Just because she was doing improper things doesn't necessarily mean she was not doing what she was supposed to be doing.
That's true. It doesn't show conclusively at a 100% level. But for anybody to say, I was just making an honest mistake, it cuts to the nature of intent to say first that she wasn't doing these things, and that information came out from Joe P. Boy and Joe P. Girl. Some of the questions was she doing X, Y, and Z with you? The answers were no. The follow-up question was obviously then, was she spending time with you? What was she doing with you? And these are the things that she chose to do with Joe P. Boy and Joe P. Girl. It followed up.
Well, suppose you had evidence of sexual abuse on the children. Would that be relevant to her intent?
I would say it would be relevant to. I would say it would be relevant to both to intent and to absence of mistake.
What's it got to do with a fraud against the government?
Well, it's.
I mean, it sounds on its face like you want before the jury this is a person that does bad things, and she's fully capable of, if she's capable of giving drugs to these children, she's fully capable of cheating on the government here and Medicare fraud, and the fact that, you know, she this is just a facade about she doesn't understand all these things. I have a hard time fitting that into the proper Beecham analysis, 404B.
Well, I would respectfully argue, Judge, that this is even before it comes into 404B, because it completed the story of what she was doing. It provided context for the crime, and it allowed the jury to evaluate the circumstances under which Ms. Langley acted with respect to the children. Moreover, I would note that to the extent Mr. Sloan raises some concerns.
But you weren't billing the government for the alcohol and marijuana, was she, would it?
Well, not directly. I don't know that she submitted receipts for her marijuana purchase. I don't know if she got receipts, but she did bill the government representing that she was performing certain services when, in fact, that she wasn't. I'd note that at the time that information came out, there was no objection from the defendant, and Jury instruction 1.19, pattern instruction, was read, instructing the jury to only consider the crime charged. And furthermore, the jury parsed the counts. They rendered a particularized verdict acquitting her of, I believe it was two or three of the counts. Moreover, this information, we saw it was soft-pedaled. We treaded lightly. It wasn't referred to in closing or harped on in any way. The information came out, and the government moved on with its case. With respect to Ms. Gerard, I see I only have a little bit of time left, so I would highlight the issues that Ms. Bartholomew raised with respect to the proof of date. She noted that the interview was a one-time occurrence. That suggests that there was no confusion to the jury, to the defendant about what she was being charged with. As this court recognized in U.S. v. Valdez, the date itself is not an essential element, and it's fine as long as the date proved is within reasonable limits before the return of the indictment and within the statute of limitations. There's no indication that any of those things occurred here. I would also note, with respect to the sufficiency arguments, the only one of the issues that Ms. Gerard raised during her hearing during a Rule 29 motion was this proof of date issue, so I would suggest it's the only one that would be reviewed de novo. With respect to obstruction and using a minor to commit a crime, the obstruction issue is covered by Application Note 5 to 3C1.1 that makes clear that there's no need to prove the impediment to an investigation. And with respect to using a minor to commit a crime, the testimony of Audra Scott showed that she was drafting false documents and she was overseeing her children as they drafted false documents. And these very documents were timesheets and daily schedules that were subsequently being used to...
But one other thing, this didn't come up in a matter of just a cross-examination and suggestion. The government affirmatively brought two witnesses, as I recall, that that testified when they were 13 years old that the defendant came to her house and gave her drugs and alcohol and so forth. Now, that's the part of the government's affirmative case. Now, I take it you would defend that on the basis that it's intrinsic to the fraud itself. I take it that's what your argument is. But I'm just telling you very straight for a minute. I find that troubling. This type of evidence, again, that's. I'm not sure what exactly it proves, other than they're bad people, so to speak, and therefore they would do this, and that's right in the teeth of a 404B.
Judge, if I may respond, I see my time is up, but if I may respond briefly. The information was part of a series of information that demonstrated that Ms. Langley was not providing the services that she was representing on these forms that she was not providing. It was important to show what she was doing. Had she been doing something else, that's what the evidence would have showed, that's what we would have proved, and that was a small piece of a very large body of information, I think over 1,500 pages of transcript for the government's information that it elicited on direct.
Okay. I understand.
Thank you.
Mr. Aberley?
Try to fly through 4 points. We conceded that the government agents were polite and all, but since the government keeps calling it an English Tea Party, I wanted to point out, this is a quote from Miss Allen. I was asked some things that really made me uncomfortable. It was things that I didn't want to participate in anymore, and we discussed that and what I should do in order to get myself removed from the list. Here's a quote from Miss Randall. Are you calling me a liar? That was right before she terminated the interview. So, they were reasonably polite, but it wasn't a love fest. Also, these agents didn't come in and simply say, Miss, what did you do with Miss Brown when you worked there? Did you see her do this? What was your interaction? It was, no, we've just interviewed your patient. We've discussed what you did. We have investigated what you did at a new beginning, and we think what you did was a crime, okay? So that's not, interviewing them about Miss Brown, which I'm sure they did as well. Finally, these two witnesses are not cumulative. These witnesses were the only witnesses who were also employees of A New Beginning, and therefore they had a perspective, particularly with regard to how the place was run and how Miss Lee made them do things and told them things were, completely permissible. My final point is there's some conflicting information in the record about when Miss Randall changed her mind. The government is relying on, I think it's a letter written by a paralegal. I don't know if the date's wrong or something, but it makes it sound like after she had this interview, she was still willing to testify. It contradicts the live testimony of Ms. Randall's witnesses, and it's certainly inconsistent with the fact that when Ms. Randall refused to be hauled into court, she had to be subpoenaed, had to be located, and when she got there, she answered every question with, "I don't recall." I mean, you practically asked her her name, and her answer was, "I don't recall."
What was it exactly that you hoped to get from these witnesses that would have helped your defense?
Well, the government focuses on the fact that they would testify about her, about Ms. Brown's, how often she spent time with her patients, her two, particularly two of her children. And there were many witnesses who testified about that. But these witnesses would also testify that the work environment that they were in was one where they were told that these services that you have submitted to me, to Ms. Lee, for payment by Medicaid are authorized by Medicaid, and that, you know, you to fill out these forms to get paid, we have to, you know, move our time around a little, and she told me that was perfectly okay to do. And these witnesses, as I said, these witnesses didn't even think they were a problem, because they thought what they were doing was correct. And that would have, you know, that was been bolstered Ms. Brown's argument. Her defense was Ms. Brown, just like these witnesses, thought that what she was doing was not a crime. When these agents told these witnesses that what they were doing was a crime, then these witnesses were lost. Thank you.
Mr. Sloan?
The most objectionable thing that the government said is that Melissa, when Melinda Langley pleaded guilty, she effectively made herself fair game to this attack and these allegations. That's really not the case. Also, the claim was made that she didn't know what she was doing. It was a mistake. No, that wasn't the defense. What she was guilty of, really, was trusting Acacia Lee. She viewed herself as being like a social worker, and she was just going to help people out. And where the problem occurred for her, this is covered my closing argument, detailing it, was she became friends with the people she was caring for. She took them in her home. In this case, the Perrier twins, they spent time with her. They thought of her as their friend. Acacia Lee then told Ms. Langley that she was transferring the Perrier twins to somebody else. Who she transferred to was Cuban Lee, Acacia Lee's brother, who then did nothing. He didn't visit them, he didn't spend any time with them. And because of that, they got angry, because they thought that Ms. Langley was their friend. And that's where boundary violations come in. If you're a social worker, you're any kind of healthcare provider, you don't become a friend of somebody, particularly when you may be transferred away from that person, and they don't understand. They thought you were a friend. So this is where the anger came from, and this is where the stories came from about the marijuana and the drinking, because we know that Joyce Perrier testified in front of the grand jury and didn't say anything about this stuff. But I assume as time went on and the anger grew, and maybe she learned what her brother had said, that then she embellished her testimony. But that was really what the problem was, and that was what the defense was, that she was really thought that this was okay according to Acacia Lee, and that she was just trying to help people out. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Bartholomew?
I did not mean to suggest to this court that there was no confusion caused by the date issue, because the crime charged was a one-time occurrence. Not that the interview was a one-time occurrence. The crime charged was a one-time occurrence. Certainly, there was confusion, because that was the issue that was brought up in the trial court. As to the standard of review, however, that does not prevent this court from reviewing the other sufficiency issues. It just changes the standard of review. And I would suggest to this court that it is a manifest miscarriage of justice when the government fails to carry their burden of each element beyond a reasonable doubt, and that failure results in incarceration. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Avril.